Thank you. Good morning. It's amazing to see so many people bright and early. I apologize to my fellow panelists as well as to the audience for my delay. I took an unexpected scenic tour of New Orleans on the shuttle bus this morning, and when we were detoured by some truck, you know, I thought that only happened in New York. So, okay, so I am the director of the John Conley Division of Medical Ethics and Humanities at SUNY Downstate in Brooklyn. I'm a nurse midwife by background. I'm trained as a historian as well, and I am a clinical ethicist, which I think very much informs this particular talk. You pardon the gibberish. I didn't realize until after I uploaded this that the template didn't disappear, but I have nothing to disclose. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about this project. It seems to me that abortion, of course, in this society remains an unresolved issue. People have very emotional reactions to it. As a clinician, I think nobody really knows what they would do until they're in the shoes of a woman having to make the decision about whether to terminate a pregnancy. And I am concerned, as I suspect are my fellow panelists, looking at the titles of their talk, about the chipping away at Roe v. Wade. And I had an opportunity, because some years ago now, I was given a group of maternal mortality reports from the 1950s and 60s in Brooklyn. And they were sitting there, and I had a couple of students work with them. And as I watched things go in what I think is the wrong direction in terms of at least access, I decided that I needed to do something with this. I started working again on these with these records about a year ago. I now have 4 fourth-year medical students, interestingly enough. Of the 6 medical students I've had working with me on this project are all women. I was all set to go to the archives of the Hastings Center, which are at the National Library of Medicine, the Hastings Center being a major ethics group, when the government shut down. And then I couldn't even do anything with PubMed at that point. And I thought about taking that part out, and I thought, well, the government still is kind of interfering with access to abortion, so I left it in. So acknowledgments are that the patients in these case reports, the archives staff at the National Library of Medicine, what I found was I pulled records from the late 60s, early 70s related to the Hastings Center, was that there really wasn't a lot of discussion at the Hastings Center at that point in time about access to abortion, other than the work of Dan and Sidney Callahan, which has been published. My medical students who continue to volunteer to work on this project, and then the folks who were interviewed by my students. So one of the things I discovered when I went to work on these on abortion at this point in time in the years preceding Roe v. Wade, as a public health issue, and for this audience in particular, was the importance of public health surveillance in the passage of Roe v. Wade. And in particular, the work of Jean Pachter. And I had the privilege to work with Jean in the latter part, well, I wasn't the latter part of her life. She was only 70 and 80. She lived to be over 100. And so let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Pachter and the importance of public health. Dr. Pachter was born in Manhattan on New Year's Day, 1911, the youngest of 4, and her father was a tailor. She was one of 4 women in the class of 1934 at NYU School of Medicine and the first female intern in pediatrics at Mount Sinai Hospital. She began working for the New York City Department of Health Bureau of Maternity Services in the 1950s after completing an MPH. Her husband was a radiologist, and she had 2 children who were both physicians. And she headed the Bureau of Maternity Services and Family Planning, and she changed that name from 1960 to 1982. Which is about when I got to know her. When the city forced her to retire, she came to Columbia as a professor of public health. And this is Jean in her earlier time. So she saw her job as being New York City's chief pediatrician and family doctor. She was recognized for landmark research in the 1960s on women's reproductive health that influenced several defining political events, including the war on poverty. Her study on out-of-wedlock births in the city of New York in 1961 became data for national initiatives on poverty and children, and she was cited prominently by Daniel Patrick Moynihan. She urged obstetricians to educate their patients on nutrition and breastfeeding, and put this again in the context of the time. Her obituary in 2012, she lived to be 101, in The Lancet, said, Not all social revolutions are driven by firebrands, and even those which are often rely on evidence of the need for change collected by individuals whose names are less familiar than those of the agitators or public orators. Jean was about this big, but let me tell you, when she walked into a room full of male obstetricians, they all bowed at her feet. The legislation of abortion in the USA was certainly a social revolution, one which continues to reverberate as strongly now as it did in the 1970s. And the woman whose evidence helped to demonstrate the need for change was a public health doctor who took the pragmatic view that if abortion was to happen, it should be in a proper medical facility, not a back alley. There was this problem, Dean says. It was there all along. Women were getting abortions or inflicting them upon themselves out of ignorance or desperation or a combination of both. In essence, the leading cause of pregnancy-related mortality was the intervention with illegal abortions. The women would come into the hospitals quite sick with an abortion that was started or with an abortion that had progressed, but sepsis had set in. It was shrouded in confusion. The women would deny any intrusion, and that was the word of the time. This very desperate, shocking state of affairs went on and on. She spent more than a decade educating women in high mortality areas about the dangers of illegal abortions with little change in mortality statistics. When I first came to work, one of the first things I was told, she says, this was verbal, it wasn't anything given to me in writing, was that we in the Maternity and Newborn Bureau had nothing to do with family planning. Sorry for the typo. Period. It was not for the city health department to get involved in. I instructed my staff that it was perfectly all right to direct them to Planned Parenthood. And Jean worked with Lewis Hellman, who was a very distinguished OBGYN, the chairman of OBGYN at Kings County and Downstate. He was probably one of the most important things that he did was what I'm about to tell you about. The medical board at the hospital sent a resolution to the commissioner of hospitals, indicating the doctors had the right to give patients contraceptive devices. The commissioner said the traditional ban on contraceptive practice fell within his jurisdiction. Lou Hellman fit a diaphragm for a postpartum woman with diabetes, very high risk, and alerted the New York Times. And it was the front page headline. As maternal mortality decreased in the United States, septic abortion became the leading cause of maternal death in metropolitan areas. By 1968, 33% of the maternal deaths at Kings County resulted from the complications of abortion. Skylar Cole, who was the vice chairman of obstetrics under Lou Hellman, and actually the one who gave me the mortality reports I have, in an interview with one of my students said, we completed the abortions. We had a schedule. We started doing dilatations and curettages at 10 o'clock at night after the OR cases were done, and we did them one after the other until about 3 or 4 in the morning. We delivered 7,500 patients a year and did better than 3,000 of these incomplete abortions. So New York State legalized abortion in 1970 ahead of the Roe v. Wade decision. And in Dr. Pachter's Lancet obituary, it stated, the result was an influx of women from other states. Jean Pachter then monitored what happened in New York as it used the newly introduced legal and safe procedures. This is Wendy Chafkin, who followed Jean as the head of the Bureau. This was in the obituary. Pachter discovered that the death rate began to decline, and this development was soon to make an impact nationally as well as locally. In 1973, when the U.S. Supreme Court was reaching its landmark Roe v. Wade decision on abortion, Pachter's data were available to show that by bringing about a dramatic fall in deaths, legal meant safe. One of the judges involved said later that it was Pachter's findings that had helped to swing the decision in favor of legislation. And this is Jean much later in her life. What I want to do is just read to you a couple of cases from these mortality records that I have. I knew the horror stories. Some of you at least in this room are old enough to have to remember, and others of you, because of your interest, I suspect, have read and thought about this a lot. So I've chosen three cases to read to you this morning. This first one was this patient was from 1960. This was a 25-year-old Negress, using the language of the time. I'm reading straight from a mortality report now. Admitted to the chest service on January 27, 1960, at the request of the New York City Health Department because of reactivation of pulmonary tuberculosis. The patient's last menstrual period was December 7, 1959, and her expected date of confinement was September 14, 1960. Her parity was 2103. She had three living children. She was 25. The patient had had eight previous hospital admissions to the chest service, the obstetrical service, and the gynecological service. In 1955 and 1958, the patient was hospitalized for 12 and 13 months, respectively, for the treatment of active tuberculosis. On her last admission, the patient had considerable cardiac enlargement, and a diagnosis of Marfan syndrome was made. During the present pregnancy, the patient has had a history of exertional dyspnea, difficulty in breathing. Her blood pressure was 160 over 110. There were no signs of failure, however. Prophylactically, the patient had been treated with digitalis and therapeutically with antitubercular medications. On March 31st, 1960, she's in the hospital this whole time, it was requested that the patient be evaluated for a therapeutic abortion based on a threat to her life and health on the basis of Marfan syndrome, hypertension, and resistant pulmonary tuberculosis. On April 12, 1960, the abortion committee denied the request for therapeutic abortion. It was planned that the patient would be transferred to the obstetrical service during her 36th week of gestation for evaluation of delivery and postpartum care. Regular antepartum visits were made by the obstetrical residents. The patient was scheduled to be transferred to the obstetrical service on August 14, 1960. At approximately 1:04 p.m. of that day, the patient suddenly collapsed while walking in the hall. Within 14 minutes of the collapse, the patient died. It was elected not to perform a postmortem cesarean section. And the autopsy revealed cardiac tamponade due to rupture of an aortic aneurysm near the aortic ring, pulmonary tuberculosis, bilateral severe and advanced, and an intrauterine gestation of 2,320 grams. And the cause of death was rupture of an aortic aneurysm. So that's one case. Next one's a little shorter, from 1956. The patient was a 29-year-old Chinese female, para 5005, so she had five children, admitted because of abdominal pain and vomiting for 2.5 hours. At 10 p.m. the night before, the patient ingested a mixture of Pepsi-Cola and J.O. paste, a rat poison. The patient was treated with potassium permanganate lavage on admission. Her condition was fair. 24 hours after admission, the patient spontaneously went into labor and delivered a set of stillborn infants weighing 1,701 grams and 1,842 grams, respectively. The delivery was spontaneous. At the time of delivery, it was noted that smoke was issuing from the rectum and it had a phosphoric odor of burning matches. The third stage of labor was uneventful. Everybody's mouth opens at that point. It's just a horrible thing. Shortly after delivery, the patient's condition became worse, and she died at 2:43 p.m. And her autopsy revealed acute yellow atrophy of the liver, toxic myocarditis, cloudy swelling of the kidneys, and a puerperal uterus. Okay, and I just have one more. I think I'm okay time-wise, right? Okay. So this one, the patient was a 25-year-old Negro female with four living children, admitted to the Division II GYN service on March 19, 1957. Her expected date of confinement was September 5, 1957. The patient was admitted because of vaginal bleeding, abdominal cramps, chills, and fever, and nausea and vomiting for 5 hours prior to admission. Interference with the pregnancy was denied by the patient. Shock was present on admission. Temperature was 104 degrees. Cervix was 5 centimeters dilated, and a fetus was presenting by the breech. Shortly after admission, the patient spontaneously delivered a 16 to 18 week fetus. The placenta was spontaneously delivered 45 minutes later. There were signs of parametritis on pelvic examination. Patient's temperature was normal the day following admission and remained so. 3 days later, all evidence of parametritis was absent. A curettage was performed on this day and a small amount of placental tissue was removed. Patient was discharged from the hospital 36 hours following the curettage. 5 days later, following the discharge, the patient was readmitted to the hospital because she had progressively become sicker and sicker and had periods of mental confusion. The patient's temperature was normal, as was the general physical examination, except for a severe stomatitis. The patient was thought to be suffering from an overwhelming sepsis secondary to the incomplete abortion treated 5 days previously. On the day following admission, the patient began to experience clonic and tonic movements. Following these episodes, the patient's condition deteriorated rapidly. Her temperature rose to 102 degrees, and within 12 hours of the original convulsive episode, the patient died. This is 8 days following curettage and 12 days following the abortion. Postmortem exam revealed subacute pleuritis with adhesions, edema and congestion of the lungs, congestion of the liver with fatty infiltration, and acute nephrosis of the kidneys. So I think in thinking about these stories, it's to me, it puts a picture, it puts a face on this. And you see who these women were, what was going on in their lives. They all had a bunch of kids who were somewhere during all of what happened to them and afterwards. And, you know, what they resorted to and in the desperation that would have somebody do this and how they died. And I have to say the ethicist in me started wondering if the HIPAA police were going to come after me. These are all de-identified records, and these are women who have been dead for 50 or 60 years. So with that, I'll leave you to ponder, and thank you for your attention. This is a large city hospital, so I think it probably reflected the demographics of the community, and my students are in the process of reading a whole bunch of stuff, and I suspect that we certainly know, especially in public health, we know that it was not only women of color who were faced with this decision, but they may have had access to somewhat better care by, you know, physicians who violated the law and did you know, so they might have had more medical supervision to their abortions and better options for care afterwards. We're trying to do some demographic analysis of the records that we have, and you know, what we have is what we have. We're kind of looking for some more, but then we may find some more. But I think it reflected somewhat the demographics of this hospital. In the back.
Can you comment more about that abortion committee and who served on it and how they made the decision?
I don't know about this particular one, but it wasn't uncommon to have committees that would look at situations where the pregnancy was a threat to the life of the mother. There were committees in OBGYN services and hospitals, pre-ethics committees and pre-Roe v. Wade, to look at issues of sterilization, for instance, and abortion. Why they didn't think that lady was sick enough to have a termination, it makes me wonder if they ever approved a therapeutic abortion. And again, out of context, I don't know that. Maybe we'll be able to find more about that, but it was not uncommon. It was probably, my guess is it was a bunch of doctors. My guess is that those doctors were largely white and male. I don't think that's a guess. I think that's kind of a given. But I do know, I mean, this was a group, there were physicians in this group who really cared about women, and I don't know why they denied it, because that was a pretty sick lady. So, okay, thank you for your attention.